Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, January 27th, 2008, from Urbana, Illinois, WILL AM Radio. It's my pleasure to be with you today. We're in the heart of political campaign season for presidential run and other races, but especially the presidency. Today we have one of the leading political journalists, syndicated columnist, and best-selling authors that talk about politics with us. David Sirota will be joining us today live on Media Matters. But first, before we go to David Sirota, sit back, relax, and listen to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. As internet technologies allow users to download larger and larger files, internet providers are warning that their pipes could be overloaded in the near future. Rather than investing in higher capacity, providers are taking other steps to limit high-volume users. Comcast has resorted to blocking certain file-sharing programs. Last week, FCC Chairman Kevin Martin said that the agency would investigate claims that Comcast violated net neutrality principles when it secretly prevented a software application called BitTorrent from being used over its network. Time Warner is taking a different approach. The company announced this week that it would be testing a tiered system in Beaumont, Texas, where the company will charge higher fees for heavy bandwidth users. This so-called metered pricing would operate much like a cell phone, where you pay more for the more bandwidth you use. But the ways that both Comcast and Time Warner are approaching heavy bandwidth use underscores the need for the United States to upgrade and improve cable and phone networks, says Marvin Amore, General Counsel for Free Press.
In a lot of our competing countries, Scandinavia, Western Europe, and East Asia, the networks provide far higher speeds, far better value, far greater bandwidth. In the U.S., mainly because we lack the kind of competition that public policy has made possible in those other countries, because we lack competition, the companies that control the networks, like the cable and phone companies, don't have a competitive incentive to invest in improving and upgrading their networks. And so companies like Time Warner and Comcast, which have networks that need to be upgraded and improved, find themselves trying to take shortcuts.
And although Time Warner's solution of metered pricing may be somewhat preferable to the Comcast's secret blocking, there are problems with charging more for higher bandwidth use.
High-intensity users are often innovators. They're the cutting-edge first adopters, and so a lot of new innovative technologies won't be produced. Another problem is Time Warner could set the buckets in such a way that it ends up just raising the price for everyone. But at best, it's an interim solution. What we really need is policy to make sure that these companies invest in better networks, open, high-speed, high-capacity networks.
Community access cable channels in Michigan have suffered since the legislature passed a statewide video franchise bill in 2006. With no state mandate to maintain public, educational, and government channels, cable provider Comcast quickly closed all of the public access studios they were housing, leaving many of the local channels with little new programming. Now Comcast wants to move the so-called PEG channels from the basic analog tier to a digital tier. Not only would the public access channels change locations on the dial, but subscribers would have to buy a digital cable-ready TV or rent a special converter to watch their local channels. The move would affect more than 400,000 subscribers. Comcast wanted to implement the change on January 15th, but judges in two separate court challenges have issued temporary orders to keep the channels where they are. Deborah Guthrie is the station manager for Home TV, the government channel for Michigan's Meridian Township near East Lansing. She says the towns are not patently against moving to digital and tried to have a dialogue with Comcast about the transition before they took it to court. But Comcast was unresponsive and ultimately caused a lot of unnecessary confusion.
The people in our community were given so much different information. Even Comcast admitted that they had problems with their customer service. And a lot of people were told different prices. A lot of people were told they had to have a digital cable subscription in order to even see the channels, when in actuality, you were only supposed to have the converter box. And it was very confusing.
Comcast wants more commercial channels on the basic tier. The company says it's the only way they can compete with satellite TV. but Guthrie says they are missing a marketing opportunity.
I wish cable providers would see the commodity, would see the benefits that they have. This is a niche in the market that satellite companies do not have. There are many people that called me and said, you know what, if I can't see PEG, if I can't see my government access channel or my educational access channel, then I'm switching to satellite. It's the only reason I have cable.
State legislators are taking notice of the problem and are now in the early stages of amending the franchise law to ensure PEG channels stay on the air. And Congress is also taking notice. House Commerce Committee Chairman John Dingell, a Democrat from Michigan, is holding a hearing on the matter on January 29th. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Come to you live today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois on this Sunday, January 27th, 2008. Today we've got a guest I've been looking forward to. He's been on the program before, and I hope will be with us many times in the future. One of the leading political journalists and columnists in the country today, an author of best-selling books, or at least one so far and another one coming up, David Sirota joining us. And David Sirota, one thing I'd like to, a quote about David I love that I think really captures his spirit. I'd like to read to you before I introduce him. The American Prospect said, David Sirota is the kind of pundit you'd like to have on your side in a knife fight and wouldn't want to cross in a dark alley. Well, on that note, David Sirota, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Bob.
You know, we're in the middle of presidential campaign politics. Here we are in January, you know, 20, 30 years ago, even, you know, 16 years ago, we would have been just beginning. But we're almost about, you know, well into the process. And I'd like to get your take on the Democratic side right now of the presidential race, what you think of the candidates and where you think matters stand.
Yeah, I think that things are still very much in flux, obviously. I think that that John Edwards has, although I don't think he's going to win the nomination contest, I think he's pushed the debate. He's been the fuel behind where the debate has moved on economic issues. You know, we now have a Democratic debate that actually is taught in some ways about corporate power, corporate greed, things that aren't usually talked about, and I think that's because of John Edwards. I think that the match between Hillary Clinton and Obama, which is an unfortunate product, I think, of media exclusion of Edwards, but that is what it is right now. It's become a Obama-Clinton matchup, and I think that what's going on there is, you know, you're seeing a pretty vicious fight between the politics of the past and what Obama says is the politics of the future. I'm a little disappointed that within that debate there is, if you listen carefully enough, there's not very many differences fundamentally on substantive issues, and I think that's a problem. I think that as much as Obama represents a change in form and a change in coalition building, I don't necessarily think he represents a significant shift from Clintonism. That is, I mean, he's got the same kind of Wall Street people around him. He's got a lot of the same similar Clinton administration advisors around him. But I will say this, I think it's good that the debate is happening and it's been vigorous, and I think that the Clinton folks' reaction to the debate has been very, very telling. I mean, you know, you've got a Clinton campaign that is now aggressively trying to inject race into the debate. Just this morning, I think Bill Clinton likened Barack Obama to Jesse Jackson's campaign, which is not an inherently bad thing. Although it, you know, Jesse Jackson, whether accurately or whether fairly or unfairly, is considered a polarizing a person among many white voters, and so I think that was yet another attempt by the Clintons to inject race into this contest, and I think that's pretty ugly.
David Sirota, you know, there's a saying in marketing that the more two products are alike, the more they have to advertise to convince you they're different. And when I look at Obama and Clinton on their voting records in the Senate, they are, I wouldn't say identical, but they're about as close as any two U.S. senators have. And on most major issues, the differences between them aren't that great, which means by that marketing theory, they're really forced to look for fairly for different criteria by which to differentiate themselves from the other, and that in politics oftentimes leads to negative campaigns and all sorts of allegations.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And I think that that's something that, that disturbs me deeply, is that I think that, that there's a portion of the public that does think that there is some major differences. And there certainly are some major differences between the candidates as humans. But what they represent, what they would, I mean, we tend to forget in these races that we're electing an office holder, somebody to be in an office. And we tend to forget about what the criteria of the office really is. We get focused on all sorts of stuff like personality and, you know, religious beliefs, et cetera, that don't have any relation to the public policy levers that the person in that office would have any access to. And I think that you're absolutely right. That typically happens when the candidates aren't very different. And I think what's disturbing is that I think a lot of people do think that there's this huge monumental difference between Clinton and Obama. And I think that what that potentially means is that if Obama was to win and become president and then didn't really represent much of a change, like Hillary Clinton doesn't really, in my estimation, represent much of a change. I mean, she represents some sort of a change from Bush, of course, but not really a fundamental structural change in the system. If that happens with Obama and everyone's expecting a major change, I think that could be really deflating for the public and so more hopelessness rather than more hope.
Our guest, David Sirota, syndicated newspaper columnist, author of the New York Times bestselling book, Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How We Take It Back. In your column now, which is syndicated by Creator Syndicate for the last, just for the last few months, appears in newspapers with a combined daily circulation of 1.3 million readers, which is quite impressive. And if you go to davidsirota.com, I think that's your website, isn't it, David?
It is.
People can learn all about you and how to get access to all the terrific columns you've been writing, get on your e-list, and get the full Sirota. You know, you mentioned John Edwards earlier, David Sirota, and he's the third member of this race. I've talked to a lot of people about Democratic politics, a lot of people who are sympathetic to Edwards' positions, but they wonder, you know, how real is he? Because when he was in the Senate, they say, you know, this guy was hardly a firebrand.
Yeah, it's a fair question. It's definitely a fair question. I mean, if you look at his record, his record got more and more progressive as he was in the Senate. That he has cast some votes that are certainly troubling to me, some votes on trade, et cetera, et cetera. I think, though, that candidates can have a genuine transformation on the campaign trail. I mean, you know, people now today tend to forget that Howard Dean was, you know, governed Vermont like a moderate Republican. You know, because he ran for president, he ran as the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. And I actually, at first, didn't really believe what Dean was saying. But I do think that over the course of the campaign, the presidential campaign in 2004, that Dean underwent a true, principled, fundamental transformation. And I think that that is the case, I think, with Edwards. Because let's be clear, what he's saying right now, and what he's been saying on this campaign, is not politically easy, even in a Democratic primary. To talk about corporate greed, corporate power, issues that make people with money uncomfortable, that's not easy in any political race whatsoever. So it says to me that what he's saying is genuine. And when I put it next to you know, his career as a trial lawyer, which, you know, defending or fighting for the rights of the little guy, you know, it says to me that, look, maybe this guy's Senate career wasn't perfect, but he comes out of the right place and he's saying things that are just not politically easy to say. So there has to be some conviction there.
You know, it's sort of a strange primary, and I know you've written about this, the way the primary season's been reconfigured and the race is coming way up front. And I think the conventional wisdom, and certainly I thought this into December, was that, as in every recent year in memory, the candidate for the Democratic Party would be determined pretty much after the first two or three elections. I mean, usually it's Iowa, New Hampshire, and maybe Super Tuesday. Then it's a done deal. That's been that way every time in memory. It doesn't look like it's going to be that way this time, does it?
Yeah, we definitely could be in the brokered convention situation. I don't know if the race is going to be over by February 5th. And I think that if there is a brokered convention, I think that we're going to that right now I don't believe the whole hype about this battle between Clinton and Obama ripping the party apart. I don't think you can rip the party apart because the two aren't that ideologically different. I do think if there is a brokered convention, I do think that could rip the party apart. And I say that because I think I put nothing past the Clintons in trying to rig the game. And the game at a brokered convention is already in many places somewhat rigged. You've got superdelegates, these extra delegates that are politicians and various dignitaries.
So the House of Lords of the Democratic Party.
That's exactly right. And they represent, I believe it's something like 40% of the total delegates needed to win the nomination. And most of them are with the Clinton machine. You've got Hillary Clinton now talking about, and her campaign sort of mentioning the idea of having the delegates from Florida and Michigan seated at the convention. And that's controversial because Florida and Michigan moved up their primaries, and the Democratic National Convention Committee said, if you move up your primaries, your delegates won't be counted. And all of the candidates agreed not to campaign in those states. And that obviously has a big benefit to Hillary Clinton, who, because she's the sort of establishment candidate. And so what she's trying to do now is it's statements in the paper suggesting that actually those Michigan and Florida delegates should be seated at the convention, even though this agreement was already struck. And that, to me, says that there really, I think the Clinton machine is girding for a lot of games playing to try to win this nomination at a brokered convention.
Let's say we go to a brokered convention, David Sirota, and Hillary Clinton goes in with roughly 40-45% of the delegates, including the superdelegates, and Obama has roughly the same amount or close to it, and then Edwards has the balance for the most part. This Edwards, how much control does he have over the delegates? Can he tell them who to vote for? Or are they basically people who are, after the first ballot, are on their own?
Yeah, as I understand it, he can certainly make an endorsement and certainly urge his delegates to go one way, but he doesn't have much formal control over where they go. I think that he would be in a position to play a very influential role if that was the case. And I think my gut tells me that most Edwards delegates would go with Obama because Edwards and Obama really are the two change candidates. I mean, Obama much less so, but is still certainly more of a change than a potential 28 or 30, whatever years it is, of a Bush-Clinton dynasty.
Our guest today on Media Matters is David Sirota, newspaper columnist, political journalist, and best-selling author, now based in Denver, Colorado. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. Our phone lines are open if folks would like to call into the question or comment for David Sirota. The number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. David, one of the big issues that drove the 2006 election and certainly was crucial for the Democrats assuming control of the House and Senate was the war in Iraq. And I've been listening to as many of the debates or watching as many of the debates, both on the Republican and Democratic side as possible over the last few months. And I sometimes feel like I'm living in bizarro world because in one debate, I've seen the Democratic side, it seems like everyone's pretty much gone to the more or less Edwards-Kucinich position, which is to get the troops out as soon as possible, the surge isn't working, the war is a disaster. And on the Republican side, it's just, people fighting each other to out-cheerlead the war, with the exception of Ron Paul.
Yeah, it's really amazing how polarized the debate has been. Each party on both, I think, public policy polls. I'm glad that the Democrats have moved to that position. I'm a little suspicious of some of them, and whether they really mean it, whether they really believe it, and I think that will be very critical if and when we get a Democratic president. The Republicans, I think, are completely out of touch with reality. I mean, I just think that they don't have a message on Iraq. They don't really know what to say, and I think that, John McCain, if he were to be the nominee, I think would be a very strong nominee, but I think his Achilles heel would be the war in Iraq. I mean, because he continues to make very, very strident pro-war comments to an electorate that is not very pro-war at this moment, and really hasn't really been what I would call pro-war in a long, long time.
I mean, John McCain, if I can interject here, to my understanding, he is the one major politician in the country who has actually been critical of the Bush administration for not being militaristic enough in Iraq.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I think that, as Democrats go to the polls, you know, when people ask me, well, who do you think is going to win? I say, well, less about who I think is going to win and who I think would be the best matchup. I mean, I really fundamentally believe that that if you have Hillary Clinton versus John McCain, it is a very, very difficult matchup for Democrats, because I think one of McCain's major weak points, the Iraq War, is very difficult for somebody like Hillary Clinton to criticize, because she helped lead the charge to push us into war. She was the leading, most famous Democrat in the country to support the war in Iraq. I think that somebody like Obama or Edwards would match up much better with somebody like a John McCain on the issue of the war. And furthermore, I actually believe that somebody like Obama or Edwards would be in a much better political situation if they were president to start ending the war. I think that Hillary Clinton has displayed a fear of looking quote unquote weak, and that she equates weakness with being against war as a first resort. I mean, I think that's happened in our political structure generally, that being pro-war means being quote unquote strong, and looking for other options other than war is considered quote unquote weak. The polls don't show that the public believes that, but I think many in the political system believe that, and I certainly think Hillary Clinton believes that. And so I think that if she was president, that her anti-war platitudes would bump up against an ideology or a way of thinking that we know that she has displayed. And I'm not sure which one would win out.
You know, along those lines, before we go to the phone calls, I just recall listening to Hillary Clinton's acceptance or winning speech on the evening of the New Hampshire primary. And I almost fell out of my chair because she started talking about how her campaign was all about taking on the big insurance and oil companies and the banks. And, you know, it's like she lifted like a passage directly from what Edward Stump's speech. And I thought I was living in a bizarro world.
Yeah, I mean, this is the candidate who was a few months ago on the cover of Fortune magazine with the headline underneath saying "Big Business Loves Hillary." She's the top recipient of healthcare industry money in the entire United States Congress, Republican or Democrat. I mean, this is a person who is very, very comfortable with those industries that you just named, and that she was rhetorically attacking. And I think what it shows, I really do believe this. I really do believe that when Obama said last night that he's running against a candidate who will say or do anything to get elected, I do really believe that about the Clintons. I'm not saying that I don't think that a Clinton presidency would be better than a Republican presidency. That's not what I'm saying. But I do think that this contrast between types of politics is really coming into full relief here with you know, I mean, I heard last, I mean, this is another example. I heard that Hillary Clinton ran a robocall against John Edwards, one of these automated calls, criticizing Edwards for supporting the most favored nation trade status with China. Now, let's remember, John Edwards did vote for that, okay? But the Clinton White House was spearheading most favored nation status with China. And it just shows that there is this politics of will say or do anything to get elected versus, I think, what Obama is hypothesizing about, which is a politics that's much more straightforward.
Our guest today on Media Matters, David Sirota, political journalist, syndicated columnist, author, author of the book Hostile Takeover, which came out last year and made the New York Times bestseller. This came out in 2006, excuse me, and currently working on a book I think we're getting little bits and pieces of in our talk today. And that book is called The Uprising, and when the book is completed later this year, we will certainly have David Sirota back on the air. The phone number here, again, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone line right now. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air.
Is that me?
Yes, it is.
Okay. There are two comments I'd like to make. First, you were talking about Edwards pulling the discussion, the debate to the left, but I'm very disappointed that you're not mentioning Dennis Kucinich. Yes, he dropped out on Friday, I believe, but he was sorely neglected, but he had, as far as I'm concerned, the absolutely best progressive policy or set of policies of anyone in the debate, and he was left out of several of the formal debates. And the other thing is that I heard on Living on Earth, which is a program that runs on the station on Saturday evening, so yesterday, they were talking about environmental racism, and that is a topic right here in this community. We have a huge site that needs to be cleaned up that's in the black community bordering backyards, and they said that while both of them sponsored a bill that Obama then kind of dropped the ball, and Hillary has been much more aggressive in pursuing policies and bills that would benefit communities that have suffered from environmental racism.
And is there a third point caller, or are those the two you want to...
Those are the two.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, David, these are issues I know you've given a lot of thought to, so please take over.
Yeah, well, with the Kucinich issue, you know, I think you're absolutely right. I think Kucinich was unfortunately excluded from a number of the debates. I do think he also suffered from the fact that Edwards was saying many of the same things that Kucinich was saying and is saying, and I think that that also helped crowd him out.
I can interject here, one of the analogies that a friend of mine, a political journalist known to our listeners, John Nichols, makes, is that for progressives in the Democratic Party, it was sort of like 1980 with Phil Crane and Ronald Reagan. Phil Crane was the true blue Illinois blue-blooded conservative, just the dream candidate of the far right, but Reagan was the one who was way ahead, and he wasn't quite as good, but most of the Crane supporters went to Reagan because they thought he could win.
That's right, and I actually think that that's in many ways a compliment to Kucinich, and that you know, it's what the old saying that when somebody replicates you or copies you, it's the sincerest form of flattery, you know. So I think that there's something to that. I mean, I don't actually, frankly, I don't actually care which candidate is saying what. I don't care if it's Dennis Kucinich, Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, or Barack Obama, or anybody else. I care what's being said. And if it's being said, if it's being voiced, if it's pushing the debate, it doesn't matter to me who it's coming from, as long as it's moving the debate in that direction. Environmental racism, I absolutely agree. I mean, this is a huge problem. I don't know Obama's record specifically on it in the state. I will say this about Obama's record. He is a person who is a coalition builder in some cases to a fault, and by that I mean there has been some criticism of him that is substantive, that says that he's sometimes a little more interested in finding the deal than he is in trying to ram things through. And, you know, depending on how you see the presidency, depends on whether you think that's a good quality or a bad quality. My take is I don't think it's a good quality. I think that as president, you need to be very comfortable with powering things through Congress. You need to be very comfortable with making real enemies. And that's my fundamental, deepest concern with Barack Obama, is that I'm not really sure if this is a person who is comfortable making the kinds of enemies necessary to make change. Because you better believe, you cannot make substantive change in this country without making enemies.
David Sirota, before we go back to the phone lines, a question to follow up, I think, on the issue that the caller was getting at and that a lot of people are talking about, which is how the political news media have been covering this case, how they cover the candidates, how they've been covering the race, excuse me. What is your take on the job, the mainstream news media? And here I'm talking about not just the print media, but also, I think, the cable television and broadcast news media, which is where so many people get their sort of analysis of what's going on.
Yeah, I think it's been, and it's a cliche to say it, but I think that it's been really, truly bad, and it's been actually worse than I'd even imagined. I think that the utter substance-free nature of the coverage, everything is the horse race. I mean, you turn on the I'm teaching a class here, an adult education class here at Denver University, and most people in the class, these are smart people. They're doing jobs. They're working. They're living their lives. Many of them can't figure out what any of these candidates are for or what they're about. All they know is who's up, who's down, and that's why they're taking the class, is trying to figure out what these candidates would actually mean for their daily lives. And I think that is a sad, sad commentary on the media. I mean, there are so many questions that need to be answered right now in our country, and that these candidates need to tell us about. And the media has focused mainly on the election horse race and the sort of substance-free sniping. And I think that what that does is, I mean, I think the reason for that, which is really what just killed me as somebody who studied journalism in college, is that I think it's just laziness. It's much easier to just get out in front of a camera and talk about the latest poll than it is to actually do research into what these candidates are prescribing, how that would affect local communities. That's why you've got all these armchair pundits. You know, you turn on the television, you turn on cable news, you see whatever pundit it is. You got the guy from the Washington Post, you got the guy from Newsweek. You know, they get on there, they don't have to do any preparation to talk about either the horse race or the latest campaign press release from one of these candidates about some attack that nobody understands at all. It takes a lot more effort to really do the research to find out what their health care policies would mean for average Americans, an example.
It's funny, David Sirota, you mentioned that, because not too long ago, someone confronted Chris Matthews, the pundit who hosts the program, I think on MSNBC, and they confronted him with all this information that all that his show talked about were these pointless predictions, which were all proven wrong, but they went on for hours and hours before and after the New Hampshire primary with their predictions and talking about them, and berated him for not talking about other stuff. And he said, in all honesty and candor, he said, well, if we don't talk about that, what would we ever talk about?
Like, that's exactly right.
What else is there?
And that's the unfortunate outlook of so many reporters, journalists, and their higher ups. You know, the editors. You know, and what as viewers, what we should ask is really, what does the predictions and the pontificating, what does that really add to the debate? I mean, the predictions, you know, they all, whether they're right or wrong, they don't really matter once the actual event happens. They haven't added anything. What would add to things would be a substantive analysis of what these candidates would mean for the average person in America. And, you know, I know the media argument is, well, if we did that, you know, our viewers would be uninterested. We're just reflecting what viewers want. Well, there's one person in America who I think, for better or for worse, disproves that. His name is Lou Dobbs. Lou Dobbs, I don't agree with him certainly on a lot of things. I find some of his work on immigration downright offensive in many cases. However, his show is based on, it reports on, it follows stories of substance: free trade, immigration, the war on the middle class, a lot. And you know, he said, he's in my next book, and he said, you know, I said, oh, why aren't you doing that for the ratings? He said, well, you know, if I went into a regular editor, you know, any old editor in the country, and said, here's how we're gonna create ratings. We're gonna focus on free trade, the war on the middle class, the war in Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. They would look at me like I'm crazy. But his ratings are skyrocketing, and so he is showing. Again, I'm not endorsing everything that he's saying, but his format is showing that there certainly is an audience for substance. It's just that the fact is that most major media is not interested in covering the substance.
Our guest today on Media Matters, David Sirota, political journalist, nationally syndicated weekly newspaper columnist, and best-selling author based out of Denver, Colorado, has had a long and storied career for someone who's so young, including writing a best-selling book, Hostile Takeover, with a new one on the way, The Uprising. He's also the co-chair of the Progressive States Network, a nonpartisan organization that works on state and local government, and I must should say, in candor, that I'm on the board of that fine organization. David Sirota got his degree at Northwestern University Medill School of Journalism and has written for countless major newspapers in the country, and for several years was a weekly segment on the Al Franken Show on Air America Radio. So it is a pleasure to have him here. The phone number for those of you wishing to speak with David Sirota, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We've got a bank of callers patiently waiting. Let's get back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with David Sirota.
Okay, I'll try to be brief then. My primary question, in terms of health care, is it true that Obama's health care leaves 12 million people out? Is it true that he doesn't mandate health care for all? Three, why not? Four, is health care ever possible in this country? And if I have the polls correct, McCain does lead Obama nationally at the moment, and Hillary does beat McCain. And a slight comment, when I watch Hillary's, I don't know, town meetings or whatever they are, she seems to have much more substantial answers. And Obama's stump speech, it somewhat leaves me cold. It's very inspirational, but at the same time, there doesn't seem to be a great deal of substance. And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. So health care in Obama, this has been quite an issue. Paul Krugman has made a big deal out of it in the New York Times. What's your take on it?
I understand it. I think the caller is right that that Obama's health care plan is not 100% universal. I tend to fall down in a weird place in agreeing with Obama's rhetoric, not agreeing with his prescription. His rhetoric about mandates, I think, is absolutely correct. Is that a mandate, simply telling people that they have to buy health insurance without structurally changing the health care system in this country, is simply forcing people to buy into a system that is rigged to create huge profits for health insurance industry and not better health care. So I agree with him that the problem is not that people aren't buying health care. It's the problem is that people can't afford health care in this current system. I don't agree with the idea of leaving 10, 12, 14 million people out of a health care bill. But again, I think that mandates really, if you're not changing the system that you're mandating people buy into, then mandates really are in many ways simply feeding into a bad system.
Can Obama beat McCain?
Oh, I believe that he would be a very strong challenger to McCain. I think he'd be a stronger challenger to McCain than Hillary Clinton would be, and I believe that because I think McCain will try to revive the John McCain of 2000, the image of that, this the image of the maverick, sort of independent, sort of populist Republican who many Democrats, at least back in 2000, very, very much liked. And I think that he will do that regardless of whether he faces Hillary or Obama. And I just think that if and when that happens, however effective it is, Obama will be better able to go up against that than I think Hillary Clinton will.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 3, Champaign County, you're on the air with David Sirota.
Thank you. One thing, a substantive response to some of the allegations going on, mainly coming out of ex-President Clinton, the stuff about Reagan, I think somebody, and you're in a good position to point it out, was that when he was governor of Arkansas, he was right there with all the rest of the Democratic Leadership Council going to forums and supporting the Reaganite move to reform welfare as we know it. So, I mean, it's cast the mote out of your own eye or something biblical there. But actually what I was preoccupied to calling about was getting away from the horse race politics and sort of reproposing the same question I made to John Nichols inside the Beltway, which is that after the defense authorization bill was passed and we were told that it was going to, you know, if it was delayed at all, it was going to have drastic effects, and then they were browbeaten somewhat to pass it. The Bush administration found this little clause in it that they had to have taken out, and they held it hostage. They threatened to lay off all these people, nearly a million in the or 200,000, I guess, in the D.C. area, and just were playing this. I still don't understand why they did that. Between that and this unitary executive pose that they're making with the treaty with Iraq, which you could tie that to the Democratic Party and their rather limp response to all of these challenges, is are they even going to stand up for the idea that treaties should be passed by the Senate? I know Biden apparently wrote an angry letter, and it was only released in the last couple of days, saying that you can't negotiate this kind of agreement with another sovereign nation. without going to the Senate. Now, maybe they don't think of Iraq as a sovereign nation. That's a digression, but that's a lot to deal with, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks very much.
Well, thanks for calling. If I can summarize that for sake of expediency, David Sirota, you know, a lot of criticism of the Democrats on this issue of the treaty, on the issue of the war in Iraq, on the issue of lawbreaking by the executive branch, have been concerned that Congress has not really stepped up to the plate and started throwing some punches, doing investigations, and getting tough with the executive branch. What's your take on all this?
My take is that I absolutely agree. I actually have a chapter in my next book which talks about the anti-war movement and its relations with Congress. My take is pretty simple: is that the Democrats have refused to stand up on the Iraq War. They've become complicit. I shouldn't even say they've become complicit. They have long been complicit. And it's pretty obvious how you stop the war if you're in their position. You use the we always hear so much about we don't have 60 votes to pass something. Well, that's the point. You only need 41 votes to stop something. And all you need to do is stop the funding for the war to begin ending the war. And the Democrats have refused to do that. They certainly have 40 votes to do that. I'll put it this way. There's certainly 40 Democratic senators in the U.S.
What are they scared of? I mean, and I ask this somewhat rhetorically because, let me ask it another way. Is part of the fear that mainstream Democrats have, or even the heart of the party has, at doing anything that's seen as too aggressive towards the Bush administration, despite the landslide election in 2006, is part of the fear that the punditocracy will just slice their heads off?
Yes. I think that what I call it in the book is the McGovern fable. I think the Democratic Party is haunted by this manufactured story that says that in 1972, George McGovern ran an anti-war campaign and was crushed by Richard Nixon. And the theory goes that McGovern lost because he opposed the Vietnam War, which is, of course, ridiculous, and is actually borne out. Mark Schmidt, the analyst, has shown that actually polls have shown that the theory is that this McGovern story created a quote-unquote national security gap for Democrats, that opposing that Vietnam War created this national security gap where Democrats looked weak. And actually what Mark Schmidt has uncovered is that polling shows that actually the national security gap developed as the Democrats led the country into Vietnam. And as Lyndon Johnson wouldn't pull, the United States out of Vietnam. And so this McGovern fable, I think, haunts Democrats today, because it's been so well promoted by the punditocracy that any candidate. I mean, when I worked for Ned Lamont out in Connecticut, every single thing that was written about Ned Lamont by the national punditry said he's the new McGovern. Opposing the war is going to mean that the Democrats are going to go down in flames in the 2006 election. You know, that didn't happen, and I think the Democrats are still haunted by that. And my criticism of the anti-war movement is that at least in Washington, the organized anti-war movement through many organized groups have been unwilling to put Democratic partisanship put Democratic partisanship below the goal of ending the war. Most of the expenditures that have gone into the anti-war movement, the Americans Against Escalation in Iraq campaign, the $12 million campaign, has been aimed only at Republicans. There has been almost no effort, no organized, serious, well-funded effort to simply get the Democrats to use the power they have in Congress to end the war. And so what we see is the partisanship of organizations in Washington, their allegiance to the Big D Democratic Party is being prioritized over their stated mission of trying to end the war. And I think that's a real tragedy.
Let's talk for a second before we get back to the phone lines, David Sirota, about the economy. You've been writing about it, and it is now universally or almost universally recognized that our economy is in for very slow growth, if not an outright recession, with the possibility of a very deep recession of the kinds we have not seen for at least until the early 80s, maybe even the 70s or before. What is your take on the economic crisis, and if this becomes a major issue in the election this summer and fall, how do you think it could play out?
I think you know, I heard, I think it was Merrill Lynch said that there's actually a 20% chance of a depression, which is further than a recession. And I think that we are in very serious danger. I think that that it is a product of a hollowing out of our economy. Our economy has been made top heavy by what I would call the Reagan-Bush-Clinton economic guidance. And when I say Clinton, I don't think Clinton necessarily aggressively pushed as aggressively pushed the Reagan-Bush deregulatory agenda, this no holds barred, the free market will solve everything agenda. Certainly in some areas Bill Clinton did. I just think the Clinton administration generally was a push in that same direction. And I think that we're living now through the results of this deregulatory privatization agenda. The social safety net has been gutted. Industry has been deregulated to the point that it mirrors the end of the 19th century. And, you know, this current financial crisis is in many ways the result of that. I mean, this irresponsible lending, because there were no real lending regulations, has now created this bubble and this collapse. And so I think that the silver lining is that what's going on is an indictment of the conservative movement. How it plays out politically is, I think, the candidates that can articulate a different vision and that can show how this recession and potential depression is a result of very specific policies chosen by our government, and that a candidate pushes something new, I think will benefit from that. I have yet to see any real overarching argument like that from any of the candidates. I mean, some of the candidates, even the Democratic candidates, are still sort of afraid to talk about, you know, the value of government spending and public investment. You'd think by looking at the stimulus package that was just passed, or that they're negotiating in Congress, it's all tax cuts. You'd think, if you looked at that, that the nation's greatest economic expansion, the post-World War II era, was all about tax cuts, when in fact we know what it was about. It was about the New Deal. It was about the Great Society. It was about huge government investment. And so I am waiting to hear a candidate articulate that, and I think once that they do, especially if it's a Democrat, hopefully, I think that will be very beneficial to that candidate, to the party, and to the country.
Well, I don't think you're going to hear it on the Republican side based on my watching of several of their debates. They seem all pretty much committed to the same policy of cutting taxes dramatically and reducing any checks on business.
Other than Huckabee, I would say. I mean, I'm not a fan of Huckabee, but
I read your column. Let me say this about Huckabee, because I mean, your Huckabee talks a good game, but then when he gets down to his actual policies, he wants to have a flat tax, get rid of the IRS.
Oh, I agree. I absolutely agree with you all I was saying is that it is an improvement that at least a major Republican is even talking about some of these issues. I mean, usually in a Republican primary, you can't even find anybody talking about, you know, the war on the middle class, economic and corporate greed. So at the very least, what it actually says is it shows you how powerful these issues are, that they've even bled into the debate in Republican politics.
Our guest today, David Sirota, author, newspaper columnist, activist, has a new book coming out later in the year, The Uprising, which we'll certainly have him on the program to discuss when it comes out. And you can learn all about his work, get a collection of all his essays, access to them, by going to davidsirota.com, Sirota. Let's go back to the phone lines now. We have callers waiting patiently. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with David Sirota.
Hello. I think you've touched on some of the things which I'm concerned about. I'm one of, I think, a great number of people who feel that there is no candidate that we want who is running who has a probability of getting to be president. And part of the reason is that we don't have faith that they're really sincere in extracting the United States from its imperialistic role in the world at the present time. We haven't had any real discussion of the military budget as a whole and how large it is and how it conceivably might help our economy, which you've just talked about. There's been no discussion of what the United States position is in the Middle East with respect to Israel. I know that's a taboo subject. I would just like to hear your thoughts on this subject.
Thank you very much, caller. David Sirota?
I absolutely agree. In a section of my upcoming book, I actually discuss how the anti-war movement has unfortunately focused on an anti-Iraq war message. And the message inherent in much of the anti-war movement of late has been that the Iraq war is not a good thing, and that it was that the major fault of the Iraq war is that its execution has been poor, and that we were led into the war on false pretenses. Now, what that says, without saying it, is that, well, we might be okay with a war that was not on false pretenses, and that was executed more properly. And I think what's a tragedy about that is that if you look at actual public opinion data, the country, more than ever, more than in a really long time, the country is actually open to the argument that we are spending way too much money on defense and military operations. I saw one survey where they basically asked respondents to rank or apportion the federal budget where according to where they think the federal budget should be spent, and the overwhelming number of people would have ended up cutting defense by a huge amount of money. So I think we have so far to date missed an opportunity to really talk about not just the Iraq war, but the war economy. How do you transition from a war economy? Why should you transition from a war economy? How transitioning from a war economy would be a good thing for America, and how actually many Americans, most Americans, believe that we should transition from that war economy. That's been a missed opportunity to date, so I totally agree with the caller.
Let's go back to the phone lines again. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with David Sirota.
Yes, I'm a 71-year-old black woman. And I have my opinion about Obama. When Obama ran for Senate, I had my own sign made because I could not find one. And I had my own sign made and paid for it. And during that time, it was a lot of things that probably didn't come out because the opponent that he was running against, everybody was focused on his sex life, what he had done. Now, then none of his voting record came out at that particular time. Voting president 130 times. He seems like he's the type of person that do not want to make a record. He's the type of person that do not want to stand for certain things, so a lot of things, you know. When Hillary voted for us to go into that wall, she didn't do no more than most of them did, because at that time they was talking about the Democrats, they was calling them, they didn't love their country, and they didn't this and they didn't that. She did what she thought she should do, and I like the way she makes a stand. If Obama be the nominee, I do believe we're going to have another Republican in the White House, because he does not have a foreign policy record. And also, he let a lot of his black people carry this race thing too far. He could have stopped it in the beginning. The comment that Hillary made and things, it wasn't enough to start this race business. Everybody knows in South Carolina the majority down there is black, and you know what they're going to do. And so I think he kind of used that race business also to cover himself. And I don't vote for nobody because they're black, white, green, or blue. I'd look at their record. I look at what is best for the country. I look at what they can do for a majority of people, you know. And the first person, the first time that I heard the color mentioned, the first time was in New Hampshire when his wife, Michelle, was talking to a group of people, and she said some people were saying he wasn't black enough. I'm not looking at his color. I'm not looking at Clinton's gender, you know. I mean, and then the media, I call them, I'm saying what Rush Limbaugh said, who I can't stand. The drive-by media seem to be anti-Clinton. They're sexist, you know.
Well, caller,
I don't think a lot of them want a woman in the White House.
Caller,
I want her to win, and God bless her.
Well, thank you very much for your call. Let me give David Sirota a chance to comment on your statement. Thank you very much.
I think there's a lot to that. I mean, I think Obama's record certainly leaves something to be desired, and I certainly think that his present votes indicate they're not in isolation. I mean, he is a person. I interviewed him for the Nation. I spent a day with him a year and a half ago, and he struck me as a person who is conflict averse. I think he really believes that the problems of the country are the problem of leadership not being able to thread the needle, not being able to get everybody to sit down at the table and make everybody happy. My problem with that is that I don't think you can make change without making some people unhappy, some entrenched moneyed interests unhappy. I think Obama fundamentally thinks that he can thread a needle and make everybody happy. I do think, however, I don't agree that Obama's campaign has injected race into this contest. If anything, Barack Obama has really made an effort to not be defined by his ethnicity. He really has made that effort, and I think the Clinton machine has really, really quite nefariously tried to inject race into this contest. I mean, you have surrogates. You have the Clinton surrogates repeatedly mentioning Barack Obama's drug use when he was a teenager. You've got Bill Clinton, as I said today, likening Obama to Jesse Jackson, who, whether fairly or unfairly, is known as a polarizing figure in among many white voters. You had Bob Kerry, the former Nebraska senator, continuing to harp on the fact that Barack Obama's middle name is has a Muslim heritage to it. So I think you've got a really nefarious, divisive, sort of ugly campaign being waged by the Clintons.
David, let me stop you if I can, because you only got about a minute left, and we do have a final caller who's been waiting patiently. Line 3 on the cell phone, if you've got a short comment or a question, I'd love to hear it right now.
Yes. On the issue of the votes present, the vote present in the Illinois legislature is a rather unusual institution. And what it usually means is the person in the minority doesn't like a bill because it isn't good enough, but they don't want to kill it, and therefore they vote present.
Okay,
it's not a vote against something, and it's not an evasion.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And that, I think, David Sirota was in response to the question that Obama's voted present so many times when he was a member of the Illinois State Senate.
Right, and the only thing I would say about that is that I understand that procedure. I think it's kind of a weak, regardless of the tradition, I think it's kind of a weak tradition. That's your job as a legislator. You either have to choose at the end of the day whether you support it and think it's a good thing for something to pass, or whether you think it's a bad thing for something to pass. And, you know, I think it's a weak tradition, and I think that it, again, as it relates to Barack Obama, it plays into an image of him as somebody who is, I think, a little bit conflict averse, sometimes not.
David Sirota, on that note, I hear the band tuning up in the background. They want to kick me out of the studio. Uh-huh. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. This hour has flown by. Let's get you back in here as soon as the uprising comes out. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. Thank you, Andrew Boyle. See you in 167 hours.